Let's talk about the subjects. I mentioned it briefly. Who was here last night? I don't like to bore people. Take one aspect of... Last night we spoke about the problem of, let's say, improper teaching of Kabbalah and some of the problems that have been associated with it. But in passing, we mentioned an idea which is worth discussing on its own, not connected to that, which is probably the most important thing that there could be for any individual, and certainly for people who are responsible for others, like teachers or parents in general, grandparents, in-laws. Outlaws. And that's it's a very interesting subject. I heard this from a Alan Godel by the name of Rav Joseph Israel. And it's something like this. We often make a mistake in terms of when we think what it is that we're here to do, especially in terms of being frum, being religious, being spiritual, trying to become spiritual. We often make mistakes. We make plenty of mistakes. We get all sorts of things unbalanced, especially people who are newly involved in being more observant, let's say. But even people who have always been observant make one very big mistake. And that is, when you make an assessment of where it is that you're going, who it is that you are, we often leave out the most important elements. See if we can try and understand this. Let's start like this. It says in Yechezkel, there's a pasuk in Yechezkel, a verse that says that the prophet, the Navi Yechezkel, looks at the destruction of Sodom, of stone, and he asks, why was it destroyed? So he picks out the reason why that whole town, many, many people were completely eradicated, wiped out, cosmic upheaval, complete destruction. The reason that he picks out is very strange. It says, because they didn't strengthen the hand of poor people, which means they didn't give to poor people. That means they didn't show the kindliness of charity. They didn't give to people who need it. Now, the problem is, the commentaries are bothered by the fact that surely there were things that they did in stone. Surely they did things worse than the fact that they didn't support people who needed it. Sure, it's important to support people who need it and to give to poor people. But surely the things that they transgressed, the negative commandments, they had blood on their hands. It says, for example, not only didn't they give to poor people, but if somebody tried, they would torture them. They would. The daughter of Lot, it says, for example, once she gave something to a poor person, she was brought up in a home where that was a value. So she, despite the law being against it, she gave something to a poor person, poor man in Spain, and it says they tied her down to the roof and they smeared her with honey and let the beast sting her to death. Right? So Lot, he actually lost a daughter because of her attempt at kindliness doing exactly that. But the law of Spain, the law of that province or area, whatever it was that you didn't give away anything to anybody else. In fact, it was enshrined in law. In fact, you remember probably that the mid of Spain, the spiritual value that they, the person, whatever you call it, the societal value that they held to, what's mine is mine, what's yours is yours. Right? So that's what they said, what's ours is ours, what's yours is yours. They didn't take away from other people. It doesn't say that they went robbing or plundering, neighboring. They didn't do that. They believed that what you had was yours and you could keep it. What we have is ours, but we don't give you. And they had all sorts of influx control and nobody could come there, nobody could get any, no one could be supported. That was their law. Now we know that the people of Stone, they engaged in terrible immorality. Terrible immorality. And cruelty, and they're such terrible sins on their hands. Why, when the prophet picks out what it was that they did wrong? See if we can explore this in a bit more depth than we had the time last night. Why, when he picks out what they did wrong, does he pick out the fact that they omitted a certain kindness? Apart from that, you can feel that surely that's not the deepest problem that they had. But in halacha, we have an understanding of this that always puts negative commandments in a more serious light than positive. If a person omits, we've discussed this before, that actually the positive mitzvahs are more, they spiritually, kabbalistically, they're the central mitzvahs, because that's building love with Hashem. That's doing things for Hashem. Whereas the negative are the guardians or the fences or the protections. But when it comes to breaking down, when it comes to transgressing a commandment, it's much worse to transgress a negative mitzvah than to transgress a positive. If you don't do a positive mitzvah, you omit the fulfillment of a positive mitzvah. That's not nearly as serious as transgressing, as breaking down a negative. If you want an emotional way of feeling it emotionally, for example, let's say mitzvahs are really a manifestation of our love with Hashem. So it's like a man's love for his wife. So in a love relationship in marriage, the positive things that you do and the negative things that you certainly shouldn't do. The positive things that you do are things that build the love, and the negative things are not to be unfaithful. Now the whole object of the exercise obviously is to build the relationship, but which is more serious to transgress? But obviously the negative. If a person omits the positive, say he didn't bring flowers today, they'll bring tomorrow. With a little subtle education. But the point is that so something hasn't been built yet, but it's not, it hasn't damaged something. But if a person is unfaithful, but that's terrible, that breaks down, that's much, much worse. So if the people in Stoim had negative commandments, they had transgressed negative, they had transgressed things that were negative, they had those to their debit, why isn't that picked up as the reason for the destruction? Why does he pick up the fact that they didn't do something positive? Can you feel the problem? One question. Another question, and many ways you can put the question, to give you one or two classic examples that have practical application. Another way you can put the question is this. It says that there's an amazing thing that it says that in the next world a person gets asked certain questions. Certain frightening questions. Very frightening discussion takes place over there. The Gemara, I think, in Shabbos records it. One of the things that happens to you is it says that there are a few things that are difficult to understand. One thing it says is that a person gets up there, and some people try to make excuses. That's what it says. They say, why didn't you live the way you should have? Why didn't you do mitzvahs properly the way you should have? Why didn't you learn Torah the way you should? Why didn't you do in the world what? So you say, in fact, the Gemara that's talking about this is, why didn't the person learn Torah the way he should have? So why didn't he develop in a spiritual wisdom as he should have? She should. So the Gemara says that some people will say, I was too poor, I was so poverty stricken that I had such an effort to make a living, I was worried about it all the time, and I had to spend every waking minute scrambling to make a living as a hand-to-mouth existence, and I was very poor. The person thinks that he'll get away with that because it says in the Shulchan Aruch that if you have to make a living, you're exempt from learning Torah. You only have to learn Torah, and the Rambam writes clearly, you only have to learn when you're free from other things that are essential to do. You have to take care of your body, for example. You have to take care of it. You have to wash, or take care of your body, or feed yourself. You have to make a living, so then you have to go out and do that. You have to make an effort. You only have to learn Torah in those hours, those times, when you're not exempt. So if a person could show that he really was serious about it, and he really had every minute of his waking life, and he had to spend his time doing that, so they can't challenge you with more than the minimum. You can't give a person a set of laws and then expect more from him than those laws suggest. So if he was exempt, he was exempt. So, but the Gemara says this. No, they don't say that. They say to you, were you poorer than Hillel? And the Gemara gives a lengthy discussion on how poor Hillel was and what a great man he became in Torah. Hillel was so poverty stricken, it says he used to chop wood and sell the wood for a few pennies, whatever it was in those days, and he used to sell the wood and make a living that way. And he was so poor that the Gemara tells a classic story. They write it in children's books. It's a wonderful, famous story that everybody knows. That once Hillel didn't have the few pennies that it cost. They used to have in those days a custom. You paid a few cents, a few pennies to enter the Beis Medrash, to come in and sit down and learn. In those days, he didn't have even the few pennies that it cost. It was the middle of winter, and he wasn't prepared not to learn. So he lay on the skylight on the roof, climbed on the roof, and he put his ear to the pane to hear what Shmai and Naftali and the great teachers of that generation were saying. And of course, he nearly froze to death. And they only realized, I think in the morning when the sun rose, they realized the room was darker than it should have been, and they saw the form of a man on the skylight, and they brought him in, and he was almost frozen to death. So that's what he did. He was prepared almost to give his life for catching the few words that he could hear from the roof. That's how poor he was, and that's how great he became. Were you poorer than that? Says the person has no answer. Then it says some people say, well, I was too rich. That means I had such a business looking after all my possessions and taking care of them. That's a responsibility, Jewish responsibility. In fact, there's one place in the Gemara that says that I'm not as great a man as my father because he used to go out twice a day to oversee all his businesses and possessions, and I only do it once a day. Which means that it's a religious activity to take care of your material possessions in the world and look after them. It's an obligation. You have to do it. So this person says he was very rich. Didn't have time. He would have loved to sit down in the Beis Medrash and learn Torah, but he was so rich that he had such a business looking after all these possessions, he didn't have time. So they say, and of course, it's a valid claim. So then the Gemara says that they say to you in Shemaim, were you richer than Rabbi Elazar ben Chasum? Rabbi Elazar ben Chasum was such a fabulously wealthy man. It says he owned cities, he owned fleets of ships, was an unbelievably wealthy man. What did he do? He put it all in the hands of managers, and he's to wander the world from one yeshiva to another with a little bag on his back, learning Torah. And there's all stories. Once it says he was coming through a field on one of his own estates, and the game warden, the land warden, whatever it was, got a hold of him and arrested him and wanted to throw him in jail. And he didn't know that he was his own employer. Why? Because he never met him, because he was all sitting in the shiva. The only thing the employees ever saw were managers who ran his whole empire, and he sat and learned Torah, you know? So they say, were you richer than he was? He made it. So it's difficult to understand. Then there's a third one also, which is not our subject today. A person says, I was too wicked. I was too busy with my yetzer. I was too busy fulfilling all my desires. Not time. That's another. Come next week or the week after for the next exciting installment. That's another issue. But the point is that when a person comes up with a valid claim, the valid claims that he was too busy. Thank you. You could close that outside door. Okay. When a person comes up with a valid claim that he was too busy doing something legitimate that's allowed to be done, surely he should be exempt from that. And if you read the halacha, it states clearly, the Rambam writes clearly, that a person who wants to learn Torah and become great spiritually, and he wants to fulfill the mitzvah karoi, says the Rambam, which means as it should be or fittingly. So that person, says the Rambam, kashiyesh lo pnai, when he's free. That means when he's not doing one of his obligations. In fact, there's a famous section in the Rambam where he counts up your obligations. He actually goes to 24 hours of the day, the classic section, a famous section. The Rambam ticks off the hours that you're allowed to spend doing various things. I think he gives an hour for eating and taking care of your body, and he gives 8 hours for sleeping, and he gives, and this is for a working man. This is for a man who's earning a living. He gives 3 hours for 3 hours a day for working, and 8 or 9 hours, I think, for learning Torah. It's 9 hours for learning Torah, and this is for a professional person, not a person who learns Torah. This is a person who is working in the world. He has 3 hours for his profession, and 9 hours. And the point is, the Rambam goes through the hours, and he makes it clear that in those hours, when you're doing what's legitimate that you should be doing, taking care of yourself, or sleeping, you don't have to be learning. And here they... Difficult question. But the answer to it is as follows. And this is the principle that we want to try and understand today. That there are two systems of judgment. There are two sets of expectations from you. There's one that we are familiar with, which is by far the less important, and there's one that we're not so familiar with, which is by far the more important. What is the one that we are familiar with? That's the set of obligations to follow the rules, right? To do the mitzvahs, to live up to Hashem's expectations, right? We're all familiar with that. Some of us do more, some of us do less, but we're familiar with that idea. You have to live up to the rules. You make certain demands. You're not allowed to do this and this and this. You expect it to do these and these and these things. You have to do that. You have to learn Torah as much as you can. You have to control your character, as we discussed last week. You have to work on yourself, build your personality, various things. And you're not allowed to break Shabbos. You can't eat things that are dressed modestly, etc. And we often put a lot of effort into these things. Even people who are so-called not religious. The Gemara says that even the least religious Jew is malei mitzvahs karimun. It's full of mitzvahs like a pomegranate, has seeds. I'm not saying you should be satisfied. If you happen to fit into that, you should try for more. But the point is that people have mitzvahs, and people are even completely secular individuals who wouldn't claim to be religious at all. But they do believe that there are certain things that they have to live up to, and certain obligations, and certain things that are immoral and shouldn't be done. And they live up to that too. However, there's another set of obligations that people aren't familiar with, and it's much more important, and that is this. Apart from the question of whether you're observing the rules correctly, Beverly, maybe you could close that door, please. Thanks. There's another question entirely, and this is something that we have to drum into our consciousness, and that's this. Apart from obeying the rules, there's an overriding question which is as follows. You were put here to do a certain job. There was a certain job of work that you were put here to do. There was a certain change that needed to occur in the world through your life. mainly a change in yourself, that you had to end up different from having developed yourself compared to what you, when your neshama was put into the world in a naked, raw, unformed body, right? And a naked, raw, unformed neshama came together with that body. So you had no work that was done on yourself yet, only raw material. You're supposed to give it back at the end of the day, different than it was given to you, developed. You're supposed to take all the raw material that you were given and show what you did with it. If you give it back the same, first of all, it says in Kabbalistic sources that halavai, we should just give it back unsoiled. Halavai, we should just give it back as clean and pure as it was given to us. Never mind not having you. But giving it back unsoiled, that's absolute minimum. The person's given raw material to do. Yes, he's given a big expense account, and he's sent off to do business, and he comes back at the end of the year and he hands back exactly the funds he was given. That's not the kind of employee that they want. You take the raw material. To preserve the raw material intact is not what was given to you. And they give you clay at the beginning of a pottery class. You hand back a nice soft lump of clay at the end of the class, you know you're wasting your money in that course. What they want is you make something nice out of the clay, give you an hour to do it, and they teach you how, and they help you along it. The whole object of the, you observe the rules, right? When you work with clay, you use this tool and you do this, and you have to know how it goes in the kiln and all that. But the whole object of the exercise is not to observe the rules. The object of the exercise is to turn out something beautiful with the clay. A person is observing all the rules, but it's not turning out the job of work that's expected at the end, but he's making a joke out of the rules. I mentioned, I once heard when I was just going to learn myself, a wonderful Sfardi Rebbe, he used to tell a story about a man who hired a truck to take a load of goods that he manufactured to Durban, or to Cape Town. So he hired the driver and he loaded the truck and he told him that he wanted the goods delivered, but he wanted him to make sure that he did it perfectly, to observe the rules of the road and drive perfectly and check the tire pressure and the oil in the engine and get everything right. So the driver understood and he said yes, and he went off, and it took him 2 days to get down and 2 days to get back. And when he got back, the boss said, "How was it?" So the driver said, "Fine, he observed all the rules of the road and I put the oil in the engine, I checked everything." He said, deliver the goods? He said, "Oi, he forgot." You know, observing the rules is fine if you're getting the job done. But if you're not getting the job done, maybe it's better not to observe the rules. I don't know, because you're making a joke out of the rules. But Joseph illustrated with a very beautiful analogy, beautiful analogy. He lives in Israel, so he gave the following analogy. He said, imagine that the lady of the house hires an Ozeret. You know what's an Ozeret? A maid. Pasha of Ozrot in Israel. It's a very interesting parasha, but some other time maybe. But anyway, sometimes in Israel when you hire Nazareth, actually you gain a master, not a... My wife hired a Nazareth, the Turkish mother of 10. We were so terrified of her. Just to move the fish with an elbow. You take the box coffee, you know, these early box coffees, you tear off the top of the packet, rip the packet in half, pour half of it. We have to leave the house while she was. Anyway, the point is that, just in honor of Purim, we're allowed to run away. The point is that, let's say you hire an Ozeret. Now, the woman comes and starts working for you, and after a few days, you notice some things are missing. Some small things are missing. The children's clothes, maybe, let's say. What do you do? What do you do? Do you fire her? Not necessarily. Depends. Not necessarily. Maybe you really need her. Maybe she does a good job of work. Right? Maybe it's debatable. Maybe you need to weigh it up. Maybe she really needed those things. Maybe you can speak to her. Maybe you'll give her a little extra. Maybe you'll watch her carefully. Maybe it's what to talk about. It's not so simple. Let's say you hire an Ozeret. She arrives exactly on time at 8 o'clock in the morning and she sits on a chair all day. She walks into the house and she sits down. She doesn't steal anything. She doesn't break anything in the kitchen. But she sits all day. And every day she comes to work, you cannot get her to budge. Every day she's, what are you going to do with that lady? I'm going to fire her. There's no question. Why? Not because she's doing any damage, but she's not doing what you hired her for. You hear? In other words, in many ways it's worse not to do the job, much worse, than to do the job and do damage. Let's go back to our questions. In Stoim, in Sodom, that terrible place that people were so wicked it was unbelievable. But because of their wickedness, it doesn't say Hashem destroyed them. Why? Because when Hashem has a group of people in the world, He has them in the world to do a job. So if they're turning out the job that they're supposed to be doing, so they're wicked. So you'll punish them for that. You'll get along with them. You follow. He'll make it difficult. He'll punish them in the next world. He'll punish them here. He'll work them out in such a way that they'll have to pay for what they did wrong. But He puts up with them because they're serving the function that He needs them for over here. But when the people in Sodom, when it says that they didn't give anything to anybody else, when they didn't help poor people, when they didn't give, so the question becomes, so exactly what are you doing here? The whole point of a human being is to give something of himself, to do something that goes from me outward. If I do things that are only perfect within myself, that means this town lives in such a way that the world has no benefit from them. That means all they do is exist. So what did you add to the world? You follow. What is this town doing on earth? What are they adding? What are they putting in? To be perfect in yourself, to be a completely closed circle that never has any interaction with the world, who needs you? Are you with me? And therefore, when Hashem saw that Sodom were doing bad things, it doesn't say destroy them because of that. Even though they were terrible things. But when He saw that they weren't doing even a small action of kindliness, that was worth their whole destruction. Because it's not a point of wickedness, it's a point of not doing the job that you were put here to do. What do we see? We see that in the next world there are two judgments that get made. There's a judgment about whether you broke the rules. And it says clearly when you get to the next world. It says that they, three malachim, just before a person dies it says, three angels gather around, three malachim. A Kabbalistic idea. And one of them it says, tots up all your avaris. Makes a list, start listing everything you did wrong in great detail. And then I think a second one says to you, why didn't you learn Torah? In the Gemara it says that after you die, they say that to you, did you get involved in spiritual wisdom? So the commentators ask the following question. What kind of question is that, did you learn Torah? In other words, if you didn't, you did a sin, right? It's implying that you should have done this. You should have worked in spiritual wisdom in terms of building yourself in the knowledge of Torah. So if you didn't do that, it's a sin. So how come it's not included in the first question? The first question is, let's check all your sins. Let's make a list of sins. Are you with me? One of the greatest sins in the Torah is little Torah. If a person could learn and he doesn't learn, that is a sin. So obviously it's included in the first question. Why do you have to have a separate question? But after what we said today, the answer is obvious. In the first question is the technical sin of where you had 5 minutes free and you didn't learn. Especially a man. With women it's a different calculation. I'm not going to go into it now specifically. But a person could have learned and he didn't. So they're going to take those 5 minutes and it's going to be shown to you as a sin. But then there's another question entirely. And that's not on these 5 minutes or those 5 minutes. That's the question of, did you do what you were supposed to do? You were here to use Torah to build yourself into a special human being. To the kind of person that you weren't when you were born. To gain mastery and self-control of your personality, as we discussed in detail last week. That's a separate question entirely. They'll ignore all the technical questions when it comes to that question. You follow? It'll go easy with you with all the technical blemishes you'll have to pay for them. But if you didn't turn out the job, if you didn't do the job at the end of the day, so what exactly were you here for? He'll rather put up with an Ozeret who helps him in his world, getting a job done, and steals a few things now and then, like we all do, than somebody who acts with perfect conscience and then sits on a chair for 120 years. The question about Hillel is Machayev Anim. The Gemara says that Hillel was so poor, and he is a testimony that you're obligated when you are. Even though you were so poverty stricken that you had no time for these things, they will say to you, what the Gemara means is this, that when you say that you were too busy with your wealth, or you were too busy with your poverty, so the Gemara means that you'll get away with that excuse, because you'll get away with it in terms of technicalities. When they show you this day of your life, and you point out, well look, I see that, and this time I was doing this, and this time I was doing this, and you go through 24 hours of the day, and you show that you're too busy with your poverty or your work, you'll get off. There's no question about it. The Shulchan Aruch doesn't demand more. The Shulchan Aruch says that if you ever have a day in your life where you can't find a minute, where every minute of the day is required for Parnassah to make a living, or taking care of your health or your body, you're allowed to. So they'll wipe it out. There won't be any problem. Then you'll get to the next day, and they'll go through it, and you'll find every 5 minutes was accounted for, legally. Fine, you'll get off. And if you go through your whole life, that's why you'll get off your whole life. But then they'll say to you, but what did you turn out? 1 second, that's very nice, okay? So technically you got off. You got up on a technicality, but who are you now? And in that question, it doesn't make any difference if you had an excuse or not. You found it amazing, didn't it? It makes no difference because you were here. So for that, you should have stopped. For that, you can't claim that you were as poor as Hillel. Because he was so poor that in other words, you understand from this, that when Hillel risked his life to hear a few words of Torah, it wasn't just that he was a great idealist. He was a great idealist. But you see that he risked his life because he realized that if I'm going to be poverty stricken from day to day and I'm never going to get the job done, well, you know, that's worth my whole life. I'm here to get it done. And therefore, a person has to know that even if they do have valid excuses, but you're amounting to nothing every day. Got another excuse? So you have an excuse. But you're not doing the job. You know, it's like if they say, I once heard it put, it's like Chaim or Brisk once said that if a person turns out to be negative, that person turns out to be a problematic individual, he's got excuses. Like, he used to say that if a person's an apikoros, that means an atheist, a denier of Hashem. And this person has got excuses why it turned out. He used to say, but he's never an apikoros. In other words, so you could be sympathetic about this individual. So he's not to blame, but what is he? At the end of the day, you follow? If a person says, well, today I'm too tired, yes, or I'm sick, I'm not feeling well, so I can't put effort into working on myself, I can't go to yeshiva and learn. So the person's got an excuse, you've got an excuse. But learn you didn't. Learn you didn't that day. You got an excuse, so you stayed in bed, so no one's going to... But what did you turn out at the end of that day? I think the idea should be obvious, that what we're talking about is a system of judgment that you have to make, each of us has to make, of his own personality, which is something that usually no one talks to us about. Normally what's spoken about in great detail is the technicality of every mitzvah. And of course it's important. Of course it's important. But the context, the person has to take one big step back and look at who they are and where they're going. You have to make a goal in terms of what it is you want to achieve at the end of this week. By the time you get to next Shabbos, will you really be able to say you're different than you were next Shabbos before? Huh? Can you say that? Can you really say that when the sun goes down on Friday night, that you're a different human being than you were? A little bit, someplace. Better, this is a bit older and a bit more tired. If you can't say that, what did you do this week? What were you here for exactly? What exactly were you here for? You want to say that you're too busy with maintenance, that's probably what you would say. You wouldn't say you're too poor, probably. I imagine, most of you, right? You probably wouldn't say you're too fabulously wealthy, probably, most of you. You'd probably say you're too busy with maintenance, right? You're too busy feeding and clothing and taking care of. That's what you'd say, probably, right? No? If you say that, so then you've got one of two options. Either you need to take time out from doing that to work on yourself, or you need to use that to work on yourself. One or the other. You need to get to the end of a week and you need to be able to say to yourself, I spent this week feeding and clothing and taking care of and being a mother. Being a wife, being a mother, let's say. And that was my idealism. And it's in that I built myself. And the whole world's different because of me this week. I had children who were inspired this week. I have a child who last Friday came home broken because... he goes to a wonderful school where they shatter his confidence. I didn't mean it personally. That is the norm in schools, unfortunately. The norm, unfortunately, except for inspired teachers, is the norm, because children are held to a standard that's set by everybody else. You're not going to come next week, right? The most important thing that children need is not whether they get the syllabus covered or not. It's to have tremendous sense of their own worth and potential and a love for learning. That's what they need. Now, anyway, the point is, I shouldn't speak to those who don't need to hear this. I should speak to those who haven't yet discovered it, right? The point is that. So if you have a child who's a victim of the system, or even who's not a victim of the system, but for legitimate reasons was fit, so if you spent the next week being that buffer and help the child through the difficulty, in whichever way, so then you have a tremendous output that week. You might have done something that week that's forming a human being for the rest of his life. You're definitely different because of that. And if you picked up the sensitivity, the subtleties and the sensitivity that's needed to do a job like that, you're not the same after doing that. If you have a marriage that's uninspired, I was going to ask for a show of hands. Then, then it could be that a few wise words, the wise words of a wise woman, with the right place and the right time, could make an unbelievable inspiration out of a very mediocre situation. And that takes tremendous creativity, tremendous self-control. And if you build that into your personality, that's, there's no question, that's what you're here to do. But the point is that you have to define that as a goal. One way you can define it as a goal which pulls both worlds together is to understand that Torah and mitzvahs are an avenue towards self-perfection. Again, If a person separates the two zones, that's not what you should be doing. Again, there are two mistakes a person can make. One is to forget the whole area of having a goal and reaching some endpoint. That's terrible. That's awesome. That's a person who just mechanically goes through the rules. Mitzvahs are uninspired, they just do the mitzvahs, but they're not going someplace. That's terrible. And at the end of the day, they may be held accountable for the fact that they didn't turn out the job. That's the first mistake. But the second mistake is somebody who does have a goal, and their goal is to get someplace special or spiritual. But then they keep the mitzvahs and Torah separate from that. That's a terrible mistake also. That's not the way to do it. Torah and mitzvahs are a way of achieving what's called shleimus. That means, you know that it says in some Kabbalistic sources that if a person has to get sent back to this world a number of times, you're aware of that. You know, that's not a, it's not an Eastern idea. That you know you're doing because you have to, and you know that they know that you know you're doing because you have to, and nobody feels it sincere. That's what people think. That is what people think. There are many, but if you think this is not so, there are many areas where it's much worse. I don't want to go into detail, but there are many times where mitzvahs, especially in the intimate zone between husband and wife, all the spontaneity goes out of it, because since certain things become certain obligations in certain ways, don't even ask me privately. I'm not going to ask somebody else privately. The point is that, so certain spontaneity goes, because there's no emotion anymore, because, you know, you function according to the rules, and if you're very frum, then you function very much according to the rules. You're not even allowed any expression on your face. You know, you've got to do... Now, can you feel the problem? Anybody who's watched a young Baal Tshuva grow up and go through there's a book called Black Becomes a Rainbow. Have you read it? Very instructive book for mothers of very instructive book to read. Huh? Have you read it? Some people. Okay. We'll all get there. Okay. The point is that that's a very instructive book to read about the experiences of a mother watching a child go through some horrendous stages of becoming frum and seemingly inhuman. Anyway, the point is that that's what happens. A lot of natural, spontaneous concern for people, all sorts of things, get terribly unbalanced. I promise you, while you're becoming involved, you can become a very unbalanced and tough individual. What's the solution? The solution is, I sought myself, and my Rosh Hashiva, I once asked him this question. A man who's grown up in a very frum environment all his life. I once asked him, how do you cope with this? Where do you get the spontaneity from? Where do you get the emotion, the heart, the warmth? He said this. So obvious, it's so simple. He said, you have to use the mitzvahs. You don't do the mitzvahs because they're technically required. You use them as a training exercise to make you that kind of person. The object of a mitzvah is not to do what's technically required now according to the clock. The object of the mitzvah is to take an opportunity to train yourself to become sensitive to the point where you would do it even if it wasn't a mitzvah. That's the object of the exercise. Not to do it because it's required to keep your mind out of it, but to use it. You follow up to you. In other words, so I said, how do you do it? He said, when you go visit someone who's sick, you don't sit there watching the clock because you're fulfilling an obligation. You tell yourself what you're doing here. You empathize. You understand what's going on with that person. You tell yourself what a wonderful person this is and what it must be like to go through. You get yourself to a situation where, and you build yourself in that way. If you do it, of course, you'll realize that it's a much higher form of working on yourself than doing things that are spontaneous. Because when you do things that are spontaneous, what happens is you do them when you want to. And you do them where you want to. And you do them with who you... You know what happens when you do things spontaneously? You go and visit the kind of person who you want to go and visit because you feel good visiting that person. But the kind of person that turns you off, you don't go visit. Unless you're a real sickly goody-goody who goes to visit people that they really hate because they feel so good doing that. But you're doing it for you. When you do it as an obligation, first of all, you'll visit everybody who needs to be visited, not just when you feel like it. And you'll train yourself to have genuine empathy and sympathy across the board. Not just where it suits you when you feel like it, obviously. But you have to do it that way. You have to do it that way. Once I was sick. I got sick in the army in South West Africa, in a tropical illness, and I was very sick. And I managed to escape the mine. Anyway, so my Rosh Hashiva came to visit me. A wonderful man. And I was quite newly involved. When I heard him at the door, I knew that he was coming because he had to. I knew it. There's no question. I was a young member of the yeshiva. I was quite new. He didn't know me very well. He was coming because he had to. There's no question about it. He was going to fulfill his obligation. I knew that he was going to... And I was so intent on detecting it. I was going to watch him. If he just looked at his watch once, I would know that this whole thing's a fake. I don't know. From the moment he walked in till the moment he left, it was so... The warmth, the human warmth, the natural warmth of the man, the genuine concern was so obvious, was so palpable, that even though I was trying to fault it, I was trying hard to fault it, I couldn't. This is something you can't convey in words. You have to live with people who've reached some level of greatness, who glow with an inner depth, and you'll see, once I was sitting next to Rav Simcha Wasserman, the small incidents, but and hard to convey even a millionth of what they mean. But you have to spend time with people who've reached, if possible, people from the previous generation where people were still normal, where there was still normal human warmth and depth, not just following external rules. You have to try and get some connection with that to feel what it meant. Once I was at the funeral, the Levi of Rav Moshe Feinstein. There were 350,000 people, 500,000 people, whatever it was. And Rav Simcha, being at that time, I think he was about 85 years old, he was unable to, he couldn't walk very well, and it was a long way to walk. So my brother-in-law, who's his doctor, took him in the car. So we were in a throng of people in old Jerusalem, tiny narrow streets, and there were at least 300,000 people. And I was in the back, my brother-in-law was driving, and he was sitting at the window. And there were an unbelievable mass of people. Next to the car, as we were stopped at one point, was a child, about a 10-year-old child, who was standing right next to his side of the car. And suddenly there was a surge in the crowd, in such a way that the child was going to be crushed for sure against the car. I mean, you know, people... Now, Singer put his hand out, and he pushed the whole crowd back, and he said, A kind! He doesn't have children himself. He hasn't had children. But I saw there an energy in a person that's unbelievable. I've never seen that strength. From a person who... In other words, a genuine feeling and a concern, right, for people that Torah development for a lifetime has brought about in the neshama of a human being. But you only do it if you have that as your goal. If you have as your goal to technically do the mitzvahs. I told you once, the same Rav Moshe Feinstein, that's all, the same I just mentioned now, when he was an old man in his 70s, I think, was once, I mean, there's so many stories you could tell about it, but was once taken from his yeshiva to the car, and they put him in the car, and they drove, they left the yeshiva, and they drove where they were going. As they got out of sight of the yeshiva, around the corner, Rav Moshe asked the driver to stop the car. He opened the door, and he took his hand out of the door. His hand had been smashed in the door. So the driver said to Rav Moshe, the people went white in the car. They said, Rav Moshe, why didn't you scream? He said he didn't want to embarrass the person who closed the door on his head. Now, you know, you can't fake that. You can't fake your reflexes. You can withstand a lot of pain when you're prepared for it. Yes, and when your honor depends on it. But you can't fake reflexes. The only way you can get your reflexes to be in control is when you become such a human being that embarrassing somebody is a more serious pain to you, genuinely in your bones, in your reflexes, than your own physical pain. But how do you get to these levels? How do you get to do these kind of things? You get to this kind of sensitivity only when you've used your... How do you see it in Poskim? Give an example. Take two more minutes. Just give you one or two examples. You take the great Reb Chaim Weizer, for example. Reb Chaim Weizer, Gazensky, you can read the Art Scroll biography to see the... just to feel the beauty of what a person can... A very sick man, unbelievable human being. You see that he was a genius halakhically, but how did he come across as a human being? He was absolute genius. I met somebody who told me that they knew him, and that he was seen to write two different tshuvas with two hands at the same time and speak to a third person at the same time. You follow? He could speak to somebody, halakhic conversation, not just nonsense, and write two halakhic tshuvas at the same time with two hands. Answer two difficult halakhic. He was only asked the most difficult. With both hands at the same time, two different letters. It's an unbelievable genius. When he's 13, he knew the super commentaries on the commentaries of the Shulchan Aruch by heart. And at his bar mitzvah, he said he didn't have time to prepare at Russia, so they just started him anywhere, and he just kept saying by heart when he was 13, because he didn't have time to prepare anything. That's it. How did he come across as a human being? So read the book, you'll see many wonderful stories. Once it happened that the Bahama was shechted, and some meat in Vilna was a dispute whether the meat was kosher. And the young rabbi, who'd newly appointed charge of the shechita, said that the meat was not good. And the elderly shoftim, who'd been doing this for years, they knew it was fine. Yes? It was a subtle point, it was debatable, but they knew. And his whole honor was at stake, his whole future. if he was shown to be that he didn't know what he was doing in this responsible position, that these older people who had no qualifications formally like he did halakhically, so what did they do? They went to ask him climbing lessons. They went to the poskim of the generation of the town. They went there. He said, bring the meat. So they brought the meat, whatever it was, and he looked at it for a long time, and this is what he did. This is what he did. Who's right? The older men were right, there's no question. But if he said so, what would happen? He said, finish off this young man who was just starting out. So what did he do? Looked at the meat, and he went to his bookshelf, and he took out a halakhic work that deals with this question, and he opened it to the page instantaneously, to the page where it was, and he laid it out on the table, and he said, well, it says like the young rabbi. Then he went to the bookshelf and he took out another one that said the same thing, and he piled it on top of it. And he pulled out another one, and another one, and another one, and he piled up opinions, great classic halakhic opinions who ruled in this issue like the young man. When a large pile of books on the table, he went out the book and he pulled out another one that ruled the other way, and he put it on another part of the table, and then he pulled out another one, and another one, another. And finally the pile that said like the older man was slightly higher than the pile that said like the young man. And he said, well, looks like we have to go that way. Isn't that beautiful? In other words, you follow what he did? Instead of just saying the ruling's like him and embarrassing someone and finishing him, he built it in such a way that you know, it was neck and neck, it was touch and go. I mean, it was anybody's guess. I mean, huh? One more story and we'll stop, okay? Got time, one more minute. You need to get inspired, what can I tell you? Once, Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, the Rav of Kovno, the Rav of Kovno, the greatest halakhic authorities of that century, that generation, also a brilliant halakhic mind. But did he come across as a brilliant mind, did he come across as a human being? Did he use his Torah to become a brilliant machine, or did he use his Torah, did he use the mitzvahs and his Torah learned to become? So it happened once in a small town, far away from Kovno, that there was, again, there was a young rabbi who ruled wrongly. There was a big dispute in that town. Two people, as it happened, were very much personally against this rabbi, and they wanted to have him deposed and removed, and they were trying to embarrass him publicly, a terrible thing. So once they went and asked him a question, and he ruled wrongly, said wrong. So they thought this is a fantastic opportunity to show how little he knows, and to have him removed. So what they do, but of course they had to show that he was wrong clearly and categorically. So what did they do? They write a letter to Rav Yitzchak Elchanan, asking the same question. What would they get? A reply with the correct answer. They'd go around town showing that here's the correct answer by the greatest authority of the generation, and our rabbi said the opposite. You can't trust him. What happened? The letter arrived in Kovno. He got the letter. He was about to reply when he said to himself, just one second. Why are these people asking me this question? It's not such a complicated question. Why are they asking me? Shouldn't they have a rabbi in their town? Shouldn't they have people closer that they could have asked? Europe at that time was stocked with great halakhic minds. You didn't have to write to Kovno for a question like this. I've never heard from these people before. These are not people who are always plying me with deep halakhic questions. You follow? Something struck. Must be that there's a vested interest here. Must be that the rabbi of the town ruled wrongly. So what did he do? Now he was in a fix. What could he do? He couldn't say what's untrue. He couldn't return it. Oh, he can't say what's not true. He can't let Torah be misrepresented. On the other hand, if he wrote back the correct answer, he'd finish off somebody summarily. So what did he do? No, he didn't. He wrote the letter with the wrong answer. He wrote the letter answering exactly the opposite of what he should have. And as soon as he trusted it, he sent a telegram saying, you're about to receive a letter in which I made a mistake. The correct answer is, and he goes, so now what would happen? If the people in town used the letter to show around town, well, it said the same as their rabbi, that they couldn't use. That would prove their rabbi right. And if they showed the telegram which corrected it, to the greatest mind of the day made a mistake, just like their rabbi, and had to rethink the question. Yeah? I mean, you want to know about simple, ordinary people who have dedicated their lives to become something, not just observing mitzvahs technically. Read, there's an art scroll book, I think, about a Jewish lady doctor in New York. House Calls to Eternity, the book. You want to read a book about, it's called House Calls to Eternity, about a Jewish woman who was a general practitioner in New York, who gave her life for her patients until she was at an advanced age. She didn't stop, in fact. When you see somebody who took a professional, used their professional capability to become a very special human being, you'll be very moved if you read that. Read a book about Reb Chaim Gelb, who was a man in New York in the early days of American Jewish development. One day he came home and said to his wife, amazing thing, simple, ordinary man, came home and said to his wife, we're only here once. Don't you think we should make the best of it and do the best we can, become as special as we can? So he sat down and planned it out and agreed, and she gave him permission that she would run everything, everything. She would take care of everything. He would just do chesed. You hear that? Imagine such a team. That from, you should read the book, you'll never be the same again. That from that moment on, all he would do would be chesed. No matter what the difficulty, no matter what the circumstances, she would take care of everything practical, and that's how she would support the team, and he would go out and do chesed. And that's what he used to do. He used to do it unbelievably. He used to buy challahs for Shabbos. Yes? He used to give out challahs to people who couldn't afford it, right, on Shabbos. But instead of handing out the challahs to the people who couldn't afford it and embarrassing them, he would pay for it before, so that the breads would be waiting in a packet with the people's name on, just like everybody else who had ordered before, so they could come into the bakery and they could take their challahs. Nobody would know that they hadn't paid before, just like everybody else. So he went to the office. You know, read a book. You read a book about a man who dedicated his life under all circumstances, no matter what personal pain and cost, to do only... Why? Because he felt he'd better do something special. He's got to turn out a job at the end of the day. He's only here once. If he's not going to do this, what's he going to do? So the two of them engaged on a... You want to read All for the Boss? You want to read about somebody dedicated? You can be inspired about people, but that's what's expected from a Jew. The summary of today's subject is simply that you have to become inspired. You have to become inspired, not just sort of put up with, you know, the fact that you're here. That's just not good enough. You have to become inspired by the fact that you have something to do. The thing that you have to do is make you somebody. The first thing you have to do is make you somebody. The second thing that you have to do is make your husband somebody. Actually, usually that's the first thing. Women usually do their job, usually. Most women usually, more or less, if just given half a chance, do their job. Most men, and it's battered into it, don't do the job. The point is that you need to turn out something out of yourself, out of the partnership, out of your family. You need to be clear that at the end of the day you're going to be able to say that you had a goal, for better or for worse, you chose this as a goal, as an overall goal, not you fulfilled the rules along the way and forgot to deliver the goods, that you had goods to deliver. The first goods were you. That's what had to be delivered. And you remain true to that every minute of the day. Every morning when you wake up and open your eyes, you have to say to yourself, just let's remind ourselves, what was the goal? The goal was to control anger for the next week, let's say. Right? And you go through the day doing that. Or the goal was to smile at all eventualities, no matter what happens. Right? Was to smile. Or whatever it was. And you work on that for a week and you chalk it up. And you keep revising it when you get into next week's work. You've got to do chazara. You've got to go back and revise last week's work. If it's smiling while you're conquering anger, you still got to do smiling. Whatever it is, you've got to keep inspired about what it is you're doing. And you've got to keep inspired as a marriage couple partnership, and you've got to keep inspired as a family. If you don't do that, you could make the awesome mistake of being able to answer technically that, yes, you observed all the rules. You didn't break Shabbos and you didn't eat prawns. Yes? You could say that. But on the other hand, they're going to say to you, that's nice and that's fine, but who are you? And then you might just find not much. Now that you're going to find. Thank you.